Welcome, everybody. PersonalGrowth.net presents Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom.
Dr. Lakovitz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. And we are picking up on the continuation of what was begun last session, where we spoke about general perspectives on happiness from the field of positive psychology. And today, the focus is going to be on perspectives filtered through the prism of Jewish thought. Let me start with reminding you of the enigma that was talked about last week, where we talked about how is it that people in the last minute of their lives, or in the week or two following a diagnosis of a child with a serious life-threatening illness, were able to, among the jumble of emotions that they experienced at that time, able to use the word happy in describing that feeling. And we began to come to a better understanding of how the English word happy differs fundamentally from the Hebrew word for happiness, which is the Hebrew word sameach. The English word happy is rooted in the word H-A-P, the root word H-A-P, which is tied to haphazard, hapless. In other words, the word is tied to the word luck. If you're lucky enough to win the lottery, if you're lucky enough to have certain things go your way, happiness will ensue. And that contrasts quite starkly with the Hebrew word sameach, which some say is connected to two words in Hebrew, shem moach, which means the place that your head is at, meaning that if your head is in a place of connection to meaning, you are more likely to experience happiness. A well-known rabbi of the last generation, Chazon Ish, said, "One who knows the light of truth, for that person, there is no sadness in the world." Interestingly, Rabbi Karolitz, who said that profound statement himself, had gone through some incredibly difficult trials and tribulations in his life. But he always was aware that if you're connected to meaning, if you're connected to a sense of purpose, then simcha, or happiness, will be the natural byproduct. Let me first talk a little bit about some experiences that I've had that brings this out in a little bit of a more clear kind of way. Yeah, I'm reminded of coming into work. I was for many years worked in a hospital, where when I'd come in after taking a few days off for Rosh Hashanah, for the Jewish New Year, my non-Jewish friends would, you know, pat me on the back and say, "So you're really hungover. How was your New Year?" And I realized how different the day after New Year's Eve is from the day after the Jewish New Year. New Year's Eve, you come back the day after, you're a little hungover possibly. If you were up till very late at night on celebrating, you're going to feel maybe a little bit tired, maybe have a headache the morning after. And it's a totally different experience if your experience of the Jewish New Year is in keeping with a tradition that includes self-examination and immersion in surrounding yourself with your family, friends, and faith, which, as we said last week, are the core ingredients of happiness. Rabbi Palm, who was another brilliant thinker of the previous generation, used to say the key difference between happiness and simcha is how you feel the morning after. If the morning after you're hungover and you're feeling maybe a little guilty about your behavior from the night before, that may come from having engaged in happiness the previous evening or in happy-making behaviors, in quotes. But it's very different from the simcha, from the happiness that you have after engaging in meaningful kinds of activities that connect you to where your head is at. And that's, I think, the core of what I wanted to start with. Maimonides actually has put this into his code of Jewish law, where he talks about celebrating holidays. And here's a loose translation of that section of what the Rambam, of what Maimonides says. He says, when you're celebrating on a Jewish holiday, obviously you have to enjoy yourself and you need to surround yourself with good wine and good food and good company. But he says, inextricably intertwined with that experience of celebrating the holiday is our obligation to feed those less fortunate than ourselves, for us to feed those who don't have the family or don't have the means through which to celebrate. And then he goes on to say, and here this is a direct translation, somebody who keeps the door of his home locked and the courtyard of his home closed and eats and drinks and makes merry alone with only the members of his or her household and doesn't make an effort to share the joy of the holiday with those less fortunate than himself or herself, he says that is not happiness. That is a way of making one's stomach happy, but not making one's soul happy. And I think that's a beautiful way of summarizing that aspect of happiness coming from the perspective of the way Jewish thought puts it. I once had a strange experience. I was at a retreat, one that I alluded to last week. It was a retreat for families of children with cancer. This was roughly about 20 years ago, and I was sitting with a group of teenagers, all of whom were in various stages of treatment for various kinds of cancer. And there was a boy who was maybe 15 years old who was in a wheelchair, and I knew from my work with that organization that this boy's leg had been amputated perhaps 6 months earlier as a result of his treatment for a Ewing sarcoma. Interestingly, just as a sideline, I've kept up with this boy and his family, and today he's happily married and has a family of his own and is cancer-free and doing beautifully. But anyway, at age 15, this boy is sitting around in a circle with a group of his fellow teens who are also facing the challenge of being treated for various types of cancer. And he said something that at the time I thought, again, was a little bit crazy. He said, you know, he said, it was worth my leg. So I said, what do you mean, what was worth your leg? He said, you know something? He said, if I look at my life before I have cancer and after I have cancer, I actually think that my life is happier and more connected since I've had the cancer. And again, I'm looking at him like he's lost it. And he explains that he didn't have much of a family life before he got sick. He said he wasn't close to his brothers, wasn't close to his sisters, and he said his father was always off at work and his mother was always stressed with the demands of raising a large family. He said, since I lost my leg, since this surgery, everything in our family has shifted. He said, my father is home spending time with me and my siblings much more. The focus of my mother's attention and my siblings' attention is all on me and the family. And he says, you know something, it was worth the leg. And at the time, I thought, well, that's a kind of a strange rationalization. I didn't quite buy it. But that was a while ago. Since then, I've had the opportunity of doing a lot of work with kids like this boy. And I've also become familiar with some of the psychological research in this area, where in one study, for example, of over 270 adolescents facing cancer, over 70% of these adolescents said that if they had to do it over again, just like the boy I was telling you about, they found more positive than negative, and even found an element of, again, happiness or of simcha coming from the experience. Why? Again, it's not happiness as we think of it, but anything that serves as a connection to meaning, that serves as a connection to family, friends, and faith will inevitably lead to an increase in simcha, an increase in happiness. One last story before I move on to some other thinking in this area. And it's a story, again, coming from a similar population, but in a different setting. I was doing a study in a number of sites of the adjustment of parents to having a child being treated for various kinds of cancer. And I had a grant, and I had research assistants going to different sites to do the study. And I was pretty proud of the research protocol, the various ways we were looking at this problem, until I started getting calls from almost all the research assistants yelling at me, saying that people who they were interviewing were angry. So I said, why are they angry? I thought it was a pretty good study. They said, they're angry because you didn't ask a single question about what good came from the experience of having a child with cancer. So I answered them, that's crazy. That would be like the epitome of arrogance to even think of asking parents of a child facing a life-threatening illness what good came from the experience. But the assistants luckily insisted that I add those questions because they said virtually everybody that they're interviewing is insisting that these kinds of questions be added. So I did. And of course, that became the most valuable part of the study. In fact, what happened was I got answers filled with a different level of depth, but insights that I think, again, capture the essence of this view of simcha, this view of happiness. Here's one example. A mother writes to me that before her son was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, she writes, the most important thing in her life was perfecting her tennis serve. It wasn't really terribly important for her to do very much. She said she didn't have much in the way of challenges in her life. But she said, let me share with you a story that happened approximately a year after my son's diagnosis. She said, my son was in the hospital, having spent the night in the hospital with my husband, who was spending the evening keeping my son company. She said there was a terrible winter storm that night, and the wind was howling, and I'm getting up, it's about 6 o'clock in the morning, getting ready to go to the hospital to be with my son, and my doorbell rings, and it's my next-door neighbor crying hysterically. Turns out that a tree that was between my house and her house, she writes, was blown down by the wind because of the intensity of the storm, and the tree had totaled her car. Her car had become totally destroyed by the ferocity of the wind, and she was beside herself. So I sat her down, I got her a cup of coffee, she writes, and I went into problem-solving mode. Together, we called the insurance adjuster, the insurance company, to arrange for somebody to come and assess her car and get the wheels rolling towards getting it repaired. She said, I then gave her a lift to her work. She continues to write that as she was walking into her office and I was driving to the hospital, I started laughing because I thought to myself, a year ago, I would have had exactly the same reaction. I would have been totally devastated by the loss of my car. But let's say, she writes, the wind had been blowing in the other direction that night and the tree had fallen on my car and it totally destroyed my car. I would have looked and I would have not thought a second about it. I would have picked up the phone. I would have called a cab to take me to my son's hospital bed. And she goes on to write, because now, unlike a year ago, I know what's important in life. I know that what's important isn't the car. It isn't a material thing. What's important in life is to spell my husband after a long sleepless night at my son's bedside. What's important in life is to be with my son, to keep him company during this active phase of treatment. And that's what matters. And that's what simcha. That's, again, connection to what matters, connection to meaning. So let me move on, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time now talking about the geometry of happiness from a Jewish standpoint. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I want to talk about happiness as the straight line, and then happiness is the circle. You may be thinking, what is this guy talking about? But let me explain what I mean about happiness as a straight line. Turns out that in many Jewish sources, happiness is compared to a straight line, a straight path, again, to connection, to meaning. There's a well-known passage that Jews say on Yom Kippur night, the holiest night of the Jewish calendar, where everybody takes the Torah out, and they sing a passage that basically says that those who have a straight heart will experience happiness. U'yishrei lev simcha. Again, happiness comes to those who are on a straight line. Interestingly, there's a fascinating, fascinating, psychologically deep saying in Hebrew that says there is no greater happiness than the resolution of doubt. Very strange, but when you think about it, profoundly deep insight. There is no greater happiness than the resolution of doubt. First time that this appears in Jewish writing is in relation to a passage in Proverbs where basically, the commentator on a passage in Proverbs that says, the passage says, the light of the eyes rejoices the heart. And here's what is said about this by one of the commentaries on Proverbs. He says, lighting up one's eyes regarding a matter about which one was in doubt will bring happiness to one's heart. Because, and here's the statement, there is no happiness in the world like the resolution of doubt. Now, what does that mean? When you think about it, it's getting to exactly this point of the happiness that comes with connection to a feeling that you are somehow on the right path. Let me try to take this somewhat cryptic way of thinking and first of all, connect it to the psychological concept of flow. The psychological concept of flow is based on many, many studies done by a well-known psychologist of happiness by the rather odd name of Dr. Csikszentmihalyi. Dr. Csikszentmihalyi has done dozens and dozens of studies where he shows that it's when we're connected to that which gives us meaning, when we're connected to something that totally absorbs us, that's when happiness levels go up. He says when we're in flow, when we're connected to the straight line of meaning and absorption, that's when people's happiness level goes up. One of the things he did in his series of studies, he's written two or three books on this, is in his study on flow, he would actually give people pagers. And he would page them randomly at different times during the day. And he would ask them, how happy are you now? And then he would ask them what they were doing. And he would connect their level of happiness to the activity. Turns out, you know where people are happiest? They're often happiest at their happiest when they're absorbed in a mindful challenge. For people who are lucky enough to have work that really absorbs them, have a job that's not a job, not even a career, but is a calling. When you're lucky enough to work at a position that's a calling, you spend your day often absorbed in happiness. And here's what Dr. Csikszentmihalyi finds. He finds that when you're in the zone where you are engaged in activity that is something you enjoy, something that you're good at, but something that's challenging, that's when your happiness levels are at their highest. And we all know about a runner's high or somebody who's a musician who's totally absorbed in the task of playing music once they've really mastered their art. Or you yourselves may know of times in life where you're totally absorbed in a hobby or in an activity that gives you meaning, and that's when you're in flow. That's when you're connected to the straight line. And that's when you're connected to happiness. There's actually a description given on this happiness straight line connection about, again, that Hebrew saying, Ein ba'olam simcha katar sesfekos. There's no happiness like the resolution of doubt. I'm going to read from what Rabbi Sinclair writes about this, and then I'll share with you a story and move on to another section before we come to an end. Here's what Rabbi Sinclair writes. He says, happiness is what happens when you move in a straight line. Every step in that line is the product of the one that precedes it. Every step carries the sum of where you've come from. Every step, every moment in that straight line demands the next step in that same line. Every moment in a straight line is both the product of every step until that moment and the map of its ultimate goal. By its very nature, a straight line must go on forever. And then he goes on to write, what happens when the line leaves its straight path and wanders? A line that twists and turns must eventually falter and end. Its own deviance spells its eventual demise. For something that deviates to the side has lost its connection to what preceded it. It is no longer an expression of a continuum. Every move, every second in a line which isn't straight, is disconnected from that which has gone before and from that which is to come. It expresses neither history nor purpose. It is a cold, frozen moment alone among other million-odd frozen moments. When the line meanders and twists, nothing has any connection to anything else. The world is random. There is no purpose, no beginning, and no end. What does Rabbi Sinclair mean here? He means that when we're connected and we experience purpose, that's when one is able to experience the sense of belonging and continuity with the generations, continuity with the present, that again is interestingly connected to the concept of flow in the straight line that I'm talking about. You know, it's interesting. The highest rate of suicide or suicide attempts is in individuals who feel disconnected from a sense of purpose. So, for example, immigrants who move to a new country and have not mastered the language and have not mastered the culture often have the highest rate of depression and the highest rate of suicidal ideation. Children of immigrants, so for example, first-generation immigrants or first-generation in any country often have a high rate of suicidal thought and a high rate of feelings of what's been termed anomie or sense of alienation and lack of connection. I was once working with a child psychiatry fellow in a research project she was doing where she was amazed that during her assignment to an adolescent psychiatric inpatient unit at the hospital that I was connected to, she discovered that she was in charge of doing admissions after adolescents tried to kill themselves. And she discovered that the first 10 adolescents, when she was doing those rotations, 9 of the 10 were first-generation Americans, meaning that their parents were from another country. They didn't understand the culture. And these adolescents felt they didn't belong. They didn't belong fully to the American culture, and they didn't belong to the culture that their parents were trying to expose them to. And they felt kind of like they were not connected to that straight line. And she did a research project that then went on to verify exactly what I just shared with you, which is basically that connection is tied to meaning. Meaning and connection to that straight line is tied to happiness. And let me end this section just with a brief story. And it's a story about, again, that statement that I started with earlier, Ein ba'olam simcha katar sesfekos. There's no greater joy than the resolution of doubt. It's a story about a person comes to see me who's in a state of quite a bit of disarray, quite a bit of feeling disconnected from his family, disconnected in general from life, and he's quite depressed. And I sit down with him, and he had requested an emergency session to see me. And I sit down with him, and what he tells me is that he's in the middle of a terrible lawsuit among various members of his family. And what's the lawsuit about? It's about who's going to take over the next generation of the family business. He said his father had started a very, very successful business, and he and his two brothers were running the business, and now his father was getting ready to retire. And he felt that the direction he wanted to bring the business in was the way to go. His brother felt the direction he wanted to take the business in was the way to go. And he felt that he didn't know exactly where he stood. His father seemed to be backing him, but then nothing ever happened, and the whole business was in disarray and falling apart, even though it had been an incredibly successful business. And ultimately, the brothers ended up suing each other, and they were going to court, and he was in a state of terrible depression, and he was quite despondent when he came to see me. So I saw him for this one session, and we were trying to figure out strategies on how to approach this, how to help him. And I had to go on a business trip for about 2 weeks after that. I wasn't able to see him for 2 weeks. I come back after 2 weeks, and I have a message from him canceling the session. So I call him. I ask him, I'm so kind of surprised. You seem like you were in such crisis before I went on my trip. What happened? And he said, you know something? He said, the strangest thing happened. He said, as a matter of fact, let me keep the session. I'll keep the meeting I had with you. And he comes in. I'm very curious now. And he said, maybe you could help me understand why I'm no longer depressed. And he tells me something that is totally confusing. He said about 3-4 days after I left to go on my business trip, he gets a phone call from his father. This was just before the case was going to go to court. And his father said, I have to tell you, son, I've given it a lot of thinking, and I decided that I'm going to throw all of my support behind your brother, not you. When it comes time to testify in the trial, I'm going to back him. And in fact, furthermore, I really don't like the way you've been taking the business, and I like the way my other son is taking the business. And frankly, I'd like you to find another way of making a living. I'd like you to stop working for me. So he said, the strangest thing happened, he tells me. He said, since that phone call, sure, I was upset, and sure, I cried, and sure, I was devastated. But as time has gone on over the last couple of weeks, I'm not depressed anymore. And I really don't understand why. He says, if anything, my relationship with my father now seems to be getting on track. And even with my brother, and in fact, I've explored some other business opportunities. My father's going to help set me up in some other businesses. And I'm starting a new chapter in my life. And if anything, I'm feeling much, much better than I did before. And he said, I can't figure it out. And it turns out that this man was familiar because of some classes he taught. He had a very strong background in Jewish thought and was himself a part-time teacher of Jewish thinking. And I said, could it possibly be that you're experiencing Ein Ba'olam Simcha Katar Sefekos, that you're experiencing that ancient saying of there is no greater joy than the resolution of doubt? And a big smile crossed his face. He said, that's it exactly. He said, my whole life, I never knew where I stood with my father. I never really knew where I stood with my brother. I was always feeling like I wasn't standing in a place of connection or certainty. Now that I know where I stand, even though it's standing in a place that I always thought would be horrifying to me, I am actually experiencing happiness. Interestingly, I've kept up with this man, and he went on to start quite a successful career, and he went on to start that new chapter in his life. And ever since his relationship with his father and brother went on to that new footing, and he knew where he stood, which is basically that his father and brother loved him. They just didn't love the way he was in that business. And ever since he went from that place of uncertainty to a place of greater certainty, his life has gotten back on track. So that ends that section. I know it's a little bit off the beaten path, but I think it's something that we could bring into our lives, which is understanding, again, that the Jewish view of happiness has nothing to do, again, with money. It has absolutely nothing to do, certainly, with the short-term happiness that comes with alcohol or other substances. And it has everything to do with connection, as we spoke about last time, to the family, the friends, and the faith. And let me end with part two of the geometry of happiness, which is another kind of thought that is shared in Jewish thinking about shapes and happiness, and that's that happiness is often connected to the straight line. The straight line is usually about our connection to the internal, to the individual, to meaning. But in Jewish thinking, there's also often the idea of happiness being connected to circles. There's a saying in Psalms that says, where King David is praying, and he says, "Hafachta misbedi l'machali." He's basically saying in his prayer that God has transformed my sadness to a place of forgiveness and happiness. But interestingly, the word there for forgiveness and happiness is the Hebrew word machal, which means both a circle and means forgiveness and means happiness. It's about connection. Interestingly, in Jewish thought, Jews only are depicted as dancing in a circle. Circles are about connection, not to yourself, which is what the line is about, but connection to the community. So, for example, traditional Jewish weddings, the bride circles the groom, and we, at those weddings, will dance around the bride and dance around the groom. On certain holidays, like Simchat Torah, we dance around the Torah, the source of meaning. And in the Talmud, we're told that in the world to come, the righteous will form a circle around God. So it's always a circle around a source of meaning, be it God, be it Torah, be it the bride and the groom on the day of their wedding. There's a fascinating insight from Dr. Seligman, again, one of the founders of positive psychology, which brings out this component of happiness and its connection to the circle. He says, in order to find happiness, we have to find meaning. And meaning requires, and I quote, an attachment to something larger than the lonely self. To the extent that young people find it hard to take seriously their relationship with God or to be part of a large and abiding family, they'll find it very difficult to find meaning in life. To put it another way, the self is a very poor site for finding meaning, a very poor site for finding happiness, unless it's connected, again, to the circle, or, which again is the circle of the community, or the circle or the straight line of connection to purpose. And I'll end with a thought from Rabbi Dr. Akiva Tatz on this component of happiness. Real happiness is what you experience when you're doing what you should be doing, when you're moving clearly along your own road, your unique path to your unique destination. That's when you experience real happiness. When you're moving along the path that leads to yourself, to the deep discovery of who you really are, when you're building the essence of your own personality and creating yourself, a deep happiness wells up within you. The journey does not cause happiness. The journey is the happiness itself. So thank you, and let me entertain any questions that you might have or any thoughts.
Dr. Velkowitz, can you explain, you mentioned the Hebrew word for Hebrew also connected to shamach. Can you translate that and just elaborate on that a bit?
Sure, sure. So as I said, it's and again, this is more kind of a hint in the word. The word sameach is in Hebrew is the Hebrew letter shin, mem, chet. And it could be understood as shin and mem spells the word shum or there. Mem and chet spells the word for moach, for the mind. So it's where your mind is at. When your mind is connected to meaning and connected to purpose, that's when happiness comes.
Thank you. And what would you say to the philosophy that many people today hold, which is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die? And they really believe that that is what gives them happiness, and that's the philosophy to follow.
Right, and that ties very much to what we talked about last week, which is, sure, that'll give short kinds of ephemeral happiness, but it doesn't have much of a shelf life, you know. For example, after you may fantasize about, you know, the happiness that'll come with moving into a new house, or so after the happiness of moving into a new house or a new car, there's actually going to be some happiness. Obviously, you know, we're all excited about that new car smell, or you have a new spacious house and people get all excited. But people usually overestimate how long that's going to last. It gets old very quickly. You know, it gets old. Sometimes it may take 2 months, sometimes 3 months, sometimes 6 months. But certainly after a number of months, it's no longer a source of abiding happiness. And so, sure, you could eat, drink, and be merry, but it doesn't mean you're not going to have that hangover on the next morning.
Thank you. And why in the Hebrew language, why are there different words for happiness?
Right. So there, that's a whole other section that maybe I could get into a little bit now, because there really is some very interesting insights there. It turns out that that different cultures have different words for concepts that they put a tremendous amount of emphasis on. I had a really interesting experience when I was in Sri Lanka. I was asked to go there with some colleagues after the tsunami, where they experienced terrible loss. And I was asked to be part of a group that was training 40 doctors in the country to help the helpers, to train the trainers on how to help them with some of the traumatic aftermath. And as part of what I was doing there, some of the doctors were saying, okay, you know, it's very nice that you're helping us with trauma, but we have a terrible, terrible problem with anger in this country. And I said, okay. And they said, can you give us some lectures on how to work with adolescents to, because they knew I was an adolescent psychologist, because they said, even before the tsunami, we have a terrible problem with adolescents who experience problems with anger control. So I prepared some lectures on that topic, but in order to prime myself to know exactly the way adolescent anger problems showed itself in that country, I asked the doctors, give me some examples. So the first doctor raises her hand. She says, yeah. She said, I had a patient in my office the other day. Her mother asked her to do something and to do it short, and she said no. So I said, okay. And then what happened? I was expecting there was going to be some kind of rage attack, or she started attacking her mother or had an out-of-control tantrum. I said, and then what happened? She says, no, that was it. She said no. So then I turned to another doctor. I said, can you give me an example? And the doctor said, yeah, same thing happened to me. You know, there was a young boy, and his father asked him to do something, and he flatly refused to do it, just out-of-control anger. And then as I spent some time there, it turns out that their main language in that part of Sri Lanka was Sinhalese. And there, they were telling me that I think there was something like over 20 words for various nuances of the word anger in Sinhalese. You know, in English, how many words do we have for anger? So we have anger, rage, maybe being annoyed. But they laughed when I told them about the different words we have for anger. And then it hit me that the reason why there were so many words for anger in Sinhalese is that in that Asian country, there's tremendous emphasis on keeping those kind of feelings in check. Turns out that in Hebrew, there are many, many words for happiness. I think also, perhaps because of our history, perhaps because of the various kinds of trials and tribulations that the Jews faced over the millennia, happiness has become an incredibly important construct. And just like Eskimos have all those words for snow, we have various words in Hebrew for happiness. And that's what I'll share with you, some of those insights. For example, great rabbi from the 1700s, the Vilna Gaon, would talk about the difference between the Hebrew word simcha, which I've been talking about, and the word sason. One of the many words for happiness is the Hebrew word sason. And it turns out that if you analyze the various passages for the word sason, is what the Gaon of Vilna tells us, is simcha is for pure and unadulterated joy. Simcha is used for situations where there is nothing, no sadness that in any way tinges the feeling of our unalloyed joy. Sason, on the other hand, describes situations where one's happiness is tinged with a certain degree of disappointment, frustration, and even sorrow. So, for example, there's one passage that talks about the happiness or sason that people experience when they are gathering spoils in the aftermath of war. So obviously there's going to be a certain amount of happiness or ephemeral joy that comes with that new acquisition, but of course it's not going to be unadulterated joy. It's coming in the horror and fury and sadness that is bound to tinge the happiness of the acquisition of spoils. There's also some fascinating insights by another well-known rabbi of previous generations, the Malbim, who talks a lot about different words for happiness. And he talks about the difference here between the word simcha, which we've been talking about, and another of the many words in Hebrew for happiness, gila. The word gila, he says, and again, he has all kinds of proofs of this from various kinds of use of the word gila, where he talks about, again, simcha, as we're saying, is a constant kind of joy that comes, as we were saying before, comes with connection to the enduring. Gila is intense and sudden spurt of joy that then recedes. And perhaps what he's talking about is exactly what we were talking about before. The gila is the short-lived nature of happiness that comes with the ephemeral, that new Lexus, the new house, the new iPod, while simcha refers to the more enduring happiness that accompanies connection to lasting meaning.
Dr. Belkowitz, is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Yeah, sure. Just to let you know that the next meeting is going to be part three in the final section on happiness in this series. And it's going to be the practical section. It's going to be what are some insights that we get from positive psychology, some interventions that can actually bring simcha or ongoing happiness into our lives from a practical kind of approach. And that would be the next session that we have.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Thank you for joining PersonalGrowth.net's Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom by Dr. David Pelkovitz, Ph.D.